Thank you. So I'm trying to give an exciting talk today on the interactions of physics and topology. I think it is true that either real physical questions, you know, like something about two brains in an 11-dimensional space, you know, might motivate new questions about Kleinian groups that the three manifold topologists haven't thought of. You know, that's one of the things I'm hoping to see come out of this seminar. But, you know, even much less detailed input from physics, just the idea that you should talk about superposition and linear combinations, might change your perspective on familiar objects in topology. You might consider superpositions of manifolds, things like that, see what questions come up. And there is actually a very natural set of questions that I want to introduce you to under the heading universal manifold pairings. And they're related to TQFTs. They're sort of the parents of topological quantum field theory. Though, of course, they were invented later. You know, mathematicians filled them in afterwards. Actually, the origin is a conversation I was having about 5 years ago with Alexei Kataev. We started asking questions about composing complicated tangles by sticking balls together. And he asked me whether you could make some kind of null vector, you know, such that when you stuck it together with itself, it just disappeared. You got zero. And I said, I wasn't sure. And then he said, well, are there methods in topology for analyzing this problem? I said, well, I'm not sure. I think we can do it, but my estimate is it'll take 100 years. But we finished this fall, so we're 95 years early. That should deserve some kind of bonus, but I forgot to write it into my research plan. So, let's see. Let me explain just first the raw mathematical context and then try to motivate it from solid-state physics point of view. So, let's let S be a compact, smooth, no boundary D minus one dimensional manifold. I won't assume it's connected. And what I want to do is talk about the vector space of linear combinations of bounding D manifolds. So I'll define M sub S with a little dot over it, because we won't be using this version very often, as simply the set of M, and most of these adjectives get repeated, compact, smooth. It has boundary now. So this is a D manifold such that boundary of M equals S. So we look at the set of all these things. And of course, this would be some ridiculous uncountable set unless we put an obvious equivalence relation on it. So what we have to decide when two of these things are considered identical. So if we have one thing whose boundary is S, and we have another thing whose boundary is S, the natural thing to do is to say that if there's a diffeomorphism, a smooth one-to-one map between the two, making the diagram commute. M prime. If there exists this commutative diagram, then we think we've just sort of reparameterized the same object twice, and we say M is for all our purposes equivalent to M prime. We don't consider them separate objects in this set. So this set is really equivalence classes.
It's an identity on the boundary.
Identity on the boundary. That's what it means to say this diagram commutes, because you included M. Yeah. So another way of saying it is extend the identity on the boundary. Exists diffeo extending identity on boundary.
revealing ancient training to try to express the simplest sentence as a commutative diagram.
And then let's let the thing I'll use more often, M sub S, without the dot, that will be just the finite linear combinations of elements of this set. So this is the vector space generated by this set over the complex scalars, and the objects are finite linear combinations. So a typical thing here is summation AI MI, and it's a finite sum. We could consider L2 sums or add some complexity, but it won't, it'll just obscure, so we'll just stick with finite sums right now. And the universal pairing, and I guess we should put in the word S, the universal pairing subject to this manifold S, is simply MS cross MS by a map we'll call glue to M, and I should probably put empty set here, but I won't after a while. I'll just call this M and maybe add some letter to remind you what dimension I'm in. So I'll put a D here. So what this is this is the linear span, the complex span of closed D manifolds. So what we did is we had a manifold on the boundary on the left, a manifold with boundary on the right. Their boundaries were identical, except for orientation. I glue them together by the identity, the boundary disappears, and I get a closed manifold. So this is a very familiar thing in geometric topology, gluing two manifolds together along their boundary. All I'm doing is linearizing it. I'm allowing you to take linear combination. So let's do, in symbols, what this map does is it takes summation AI MI cross summation BJ NJ to summation AI BJ bar times NI NJ bar, where this bar is complex conjugation. So I've made sort of a Hermitian pairing. And this bar here, this first one's an M, this is an N. And this bar is reverse of orientation. So, you know, this is very much like bras and kets, okay? I took superposition of manifolds, if you like, bounding S on the left, and I thought of it then as I took some other superposition also on the left, but then I turn it around, that's reversing the orientation. And I glue these together. So let's do a simple example. Remember I said S might be disconnected. So suppose D is equal 1. Oh, did I leave that out? Yeah. Yep. Oriented. Thank you. So suppose S is 4 points. And I guess since it's oriented manifolds, as David just reminded me, let's say that they're oriented in this manner. And let's consider two possible guys that bound. So here's one guy that bounds, that oriented one manifold. And here's a different bounding oriented one manifold. So we could call the red one M and call the green one N. Okay? And actually, this is a good example to test our definitions on. You know, why are they different? Because after all, two arcs is homeomorphic to two arcs.
So why aren't they the same one-dimensional manifold bounding S? The reason is the diffeomorphism, the identification of the intervals, can't be made identity on the boundary. Okay. So now what would happen if we paired M and S? Well, we just simply get this picture. So M N bar, I should have changed the colors there. M N bar would simply look like this. So it would be a circle. It's a closed manifold, as I warned you. It has no boundary. We used up the boundary when we glued. And this is a circle, S1. Let's just, because it'll come up in a second, let's figure out what M minus N, that bra paired with this ket, is. So minus now is formal. It's a formal combination of things. So this is going to, this is basically bilinear. I mean, it's sesquilinear. There's a bar on this side, but the scale, these are all real, so we won't see that in this example. So this will have four terms, which are simply M minus M N minus N M plus N N. And I probably will leave out the bars after a while, but there they are now. So it's a superposition of four manifolds. And what are the manifolds? This one is two circles. This one is one circle. This one is one circle. These have minuses. And this is two circles again, plus. So we get that the computation is that this inner product is, it's not a scalar, you see. The inner products are taking values in a vector space. Maybe we could turn this into a ring if we wanted, but think of it as a vector space right now. And the answer is 2 times S1. Sorry, 2 times 2S1, where this 2 means 2, well, okay, let's be better notation. 2 times S1 disjoint union S1 minus 2 times S1. That was the answer of the inner product. So in particular, this was not a light-like vector. This was not a vector whose inner product with itself was 0. So this goes back to the original question that we started discussing. Are there vectors whose inner product just in the manifold world, in this completely abstract domain, are 0? Because in a certain sense, such combinations of manifolds would be invisible to any unitary TQFT. So let me now explain that connection. To make explicit how this is related to a TQFT structure. Okay, so we have MS cross MS to M. And now, suppose we wanted to kind of pair not into manifolds, which is a kind of weird place. Suppose we wanted to pair into the scalars, be more normal like everyone else. Then what we'd like to do is we'd like to come up with an action and integrate that action to get a partition function from closed manifolds down into the scalars and extend linearly. So a very simple example of this would be if D equals 3, we could let the action be the Chern-Simons functional on a connection, and then write Z as the integral this is this physics notation over the space of connections of e to the minus 2 pi I k Chern-Simons functional of the connection, where this Chern-Simons functional, you know, is something like 1 over 8 pi squared a wedge dA plus 2/3 a wedge a, this kind of thing. So the reason I wrote out one example is, in order for this to make any sense, this action better be a topologically invariant action, or we can't possibly define it from a manifold, it would have to then be a manifold with a metric or some other structure if it wasn't generally covariant.
But suppose we do have an action in mind and create a partition function, then we're free to form quotients of these spaces by simply dividing by the nullity. If we take this composed pairing here, we'll see vectors that pair zero with everything else. Those are called null vectors. And if we divide by the nullity, then we'll get a non-singular pairing from quotient spaces, which I'll call V for vector space and Z because it's associated with this particular partition function. So this is a perfectly good way. It's not the usual way, but this is a perfectly good way of building the Witten, Chern, Simons TQFTs in 2 plus 1 dimensions. You can say that all you do is you start with the universal pairing, which glues three manifolds with a fixed boundary to get closed three manifolds. You insert the partition function. This is the way Witten would express the partition function of this TQFT. This is the closed manifold invariant. But the more interesting structure of a TQFT is really in lower dimensions. It's the vector space associated to surfaces and the particle types associated to circles and so on. So this is a way of sort of a top-down approach where you start with the universal structure, you input the closed manifold invariant in the form of the partition function. It just has to be given by some local expressions. It essentially has to be defined by integrating local fields. And then it follows that there's a general functorial machinery that you can apply to produce the Hilbert spaces associated with the one lower dimensional objects, in this case the surfaces, and on down.
Does that depend at all on the choice of action function of the universe?
Well, it better be.
I know the definition of the theory, so it depends on what you define it.
So
what we're talking about is essentially this topological information about this manifold M.
Depending on what functional you insert here, you can produce more or less of this full structure of a TQFT. So let me review what the essential points of a TQFT are, okay? So this is a very quick review of D minus 1 plus 1 dimensional TQFT. So just, for people who are not used to the terminology, somewhere in physics it was decreed that you should call these things D plus 1 dimensional or N plus 1 dimensional. This is actually a very good idea because there's space and there's time, and the most usual examples, the Chern-Simons examples, no one can decide if you should call them two or three dimensional examples because the physics is on a surface and then it evolves in time to make a space-time. So you solve this ambiguity and you don't have to answer all these annoying questions in the middle of every sentence by just calling it two plus one dimensional. So that's the main case, is D minus one equals two. So I'm mostly thinking about D equals 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFTs, okay? So what is a 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFT? And I'll just for specificity say it in these dimensions, but you could change 2 to D minus 1. So what it does is, given a closed 3-manifold, also oriented, compact, smooth, all that stuff, it gives a number. So it gives what's called the partition function of the manifold in the complex numbers. Okay, that's sort of the highest level. Stepping down a level, if you have a compact-oriented 2-manifold, so a surface, you get a vector space. Actually, in the important cases, if it's a unitary TQFT, this is actually a Hilbert space. It's a Hermitian space with its inner product. And my main focus today will be on unitary TQFTs.
So you get some Hilbert space associated to the surface sigma. It's always a vector space. It has a Hermitian structure if T50 is unitary. And if you have this picture, if you have a, just what we were talking about, you have a manifold M and the boundary sigma, then what this is supposed to do is give you a vector in this Hilbert space. Okay, so given this situation, the TQFT assigns, I'll just call it V of sigma belonging, no, sorry, V of M belonging to V of sigma, capital V of sigma, okay? And this is step one, this is step two. There's one third step that unites the two, which is gluing. Suppose you have not only M whose boundary is sigma, but you also have M prime whose boundary is sigma. Now you can stick them together to get a closed manifold, M union M prime bar. And the third axiom says that this first thing, the partition function Z of the glued guy, is just equal the dot product with respect to the center product space structure of the two V's. Okay, so this much structure is usually called the Atiyah axioms, and they go back to the late 80s when I guess Atiyah was trying to explain to mathematicians what Witten was thinking, and he abstracted these axioms. If you actually look at Atiyah's paper in topology, you'll see that this is a trimmed down exposition. There should be some central extensions and some phase ambiguities. You really don't want to define this as a functor on manifolds in the raw, but endow them with a some kind of structure, partial lifting of their tangent bundle, which allows you to make certain representations on the nose that it, that otherwise are just projective. So I want to, for today, sort of sweep under some phase ambiguities, sweep them under the rug and not go into them, and say these are the Atiyah axioms. Now, in answer to Amanda's question, if this is any function, we get this far. We don't necessarily get finite dimensional, and we don't necessarily I think basically you get this far with any functional, except these spaces might be infinite dimensional. It's just a purely formal thing. I mean, nothing is to stop you from thinking of manifolds on the left as functionals on manifolds on the right when you pair according to even the most ridiculous of partition functions, like the number of simplices necessary to describe the manifold. But if you want to go to the further list of axioms, which are actually quite important for the internal structure of a TQFT, then this partition function actually has to come from integrating local fields. It has to really be from an action. And the finer axioms have to do with gluing one lower dimension. So they have to do with trying to express the Hilbert space for this surface, for example, a genus 2 surface, as in some way built from a tensor product of these two pieces. And you, people who know this theory know it's not just strictly a tensor product, but even to define these Hilbert spaces for surfaces with boundary, you know, which is already outside of this formalism, you have to come to grips with the idea of a label for the boundary components, which is always some kind of irreducible representation of a loop group or something. So this becomes a sum over labels. So I don't want to do this in detail now, but the point is there's a more refined discussion, more refined structure of TQFT that I won't be addressing today. I'm just going to work with the Atiyah axioms, which would need the local nature of these partition functions.
Can you explain what you meant by
finality? Oh, well, sure. Suppose you have a vector here, and such that... let's give this a name, this pairing capital P. Suppose you have a vector V such that
P, V, W, composed with Z, equals zero for all W.
So that I would call that vector in the nullity of the pairing, of this pairing,
P followed by Z.
And then just formally, there's a quotient. Obviously, this plays no role when I pair. If I
have some other vector V prime that doesn't have this property and I add V to it
and I expand things out bilinearly, this just disappears from the answer. So it makes sense to form the quotient space where I divide out by the nullity. So let me try to tie this to very concrete bit of physics by focusing on the possibility of a null vector, and then I'll actually show you an example where there are null vectors. Actually, let me invert the order. I think the exposition will make more sense if I first show you that there are vectors that pair zero with themselves in some dimension. So you'll have to take some of this on trust because there are calculations involved. But I'll just summarize sort of what goes into the calculations and what the example is. So let me take a quick digression. I'm going to mostly be thinking about d equals 3, but this will be a digression to d equals 4. So d minus 1 is equal to 3. And there's something called the Maser there's something called the Maser manifold. So as far as the eyes of homology is concerned, the homology functor, the Maser manifold looks like a disk. Okay, it looks like it's a three-sphere on the boundary bounded by a disk. It's actually a homology three-sphere bounded by a contractible manifold. And we, for people who would want to see that we have this well in hand and we actually can write down an exact description of this, you can use what's called the Kirby link calculus to describe this manifold explicitly. So what I've drawn here is a two-component link, and if I hope it's fairly clear. And implicitly, I'm considering zero framing on this. So if I want to make that explicit, I should write a little zero next to each component. And this is some kind of topologist notation for a closed manifold. What it tells a topologist to do is cut out a solid torus, which is a neighborhood of each of these components, and glue back in a solid torus according to the matrix 0, 1, 1, 0. So in other words, you glue back in the solid torus, interchanging meridian and longitude.
It's a separate operation of each solid torus?
Yeah, that's right. Now, one thing to notice is if you add just one solid torus, each one separately is unknotted. That's quite clear for the pink circle, but also true for the white one. If you look closely, it's unknotted. So you don't get a very interesting manifold. You get a pretty standard manifold called S1 cross S2 if you just do one of these two. But when you do both, the fact that they're linked comes into play. Okay, and you can calculate the homology of the manifold that results just by knowing the linking number of this link. And the linking number is 1 because, you see, there are 3 strands that go through, but if you look at this kind of clasp, you'll see that 2 of the strands cancel according to sign. There's one goes forward and one goes back. So up to linking, this is very much like this link in terms of linking numbers. It's a more complicated geometric example, but it has the same linking number of this as this. So if you did the surgery operation on this link, you just get back the ordinary old 3-sphere. That's very easy to check. And here you get back some homological version of it. Now, there's a way of sort of changing the description here to actually describe not just a 3-dimensional manifold, but a 4-dimensional manifold whose boundary is this very guy. And the way you do that is you take either one of these 2 curves. Let's say you take the pink one, and you say that it's going to somehow label a 1 handle attached to the 4-dimensional ball. So if you take the 4-dimensional ball and you take 2 disjoint 3 disks in its boundary and connect them by what would be a handle in that dimension, 3 disk cross interval, then on the boundary you get a very standard thing. The boundary of this equals S1 cross S2, which is what I mentioned was the result of doing one of the 2 surgeries. So you can think of the red curve as somehow describing the boundary after you've attached this 1 handle. And then the white curve is now not thought of anymore as placed in the 3-sphere or 3-space, but placed in the boundary of this previous construction. And then you can use it as the directions, the instructions, for attaching a 2-dimensional handle. A 2-dimensional handle is simply a D2 thickened in the normal direction, that's cross D2, relative boundary. So the attaching region is, this is a solid torus. And it tells you how this white curve kind of bears down onto the boundary here, and it's supposed to bear down and come in right along this white curve. And there's a twisting information, which we set equal to 0. You need to say how it twists to be perfectly precise. And that gives a very explicit description of what's called the Maser manifold. So this is a well-known example in topology. And we can let M, you know, we can think of M as one of our cats, or bras, or whatever, right? In other words, this we can think of this as belonging to the manifolds that bound the Maser manifold, right? Or the Maser 3-sphere.
This will be the Maser 3-sphere.
And I can erase the dot. I just mean 1 times the Maser manifold and write it this way. Now, it turns out that there's a very natural variant on the Maser manifold. I'll just call it M prime, which is another guy in here with the same boundary. And actually, the secret is that actually the manifolds are the same also. But just like my example with arcs, they're the same, but by a diffeomorphism, which is not the identity on the boundary. So they're really different vectors in the space. And if you want to know what the diffeomorphism of the boundary is that reattaches the Maser manifold M to give you M prime, you can actually see it from this picture. This link is a symmetrical link. If you make this out of string with 2 colors of string, it's possible to wiggle it around in space and bring it back so that the white one has become in this position and the red one in this position. And if you do that little wiggling around and so on and think of extended isotopy, ambient isotopy of the complement, you're doing nothing other than discovering the diffeomorphism of the boundary that distinguishes M from M prime. So
it's quite fun now, and this bit of fun is in a paper that is on the archive with Wong, Slingerland, Walker, and Alexei Kitayev, and Chetanayak. This was sort of our lunchtime work for several months up at Microsoft. We always come back to this question. So if you take the difference, if you pair this manifold with itself, this has four terms, just like our earlier example. And it's quite easy to see that all the terms are going to be homology spheres, because these are homology disks. But the brilliant thing is, when you actually do the calculation, which is, you know, just something you need to learn how to do, it's not hard, but it just takes some, you know, training or something. When you do the calculation, all the terms come out to be diffeomorphic to S4. So the answer to this computation is S4 minus S4 minus S4 plus S4. The signs are just what we had before, which is 0. So that's the magic. So we found a null vector. So if you like, there are two parts to the story. There's one part to check the vector's null, which is simple brute force geometric topology calculation. There's another part of the story which is maybe more interesting, which is to check that it was a vector in the first place. Like, how did I know that this commutative diagram didn't exist, that I couldn't extend the identity over M prime? Well, that's gauge theory in the hands of Akbalut. I mean, this example, in a way, goes back to the 80s. In the late 1980s, Selman Akbalut showed that if you took the Kummer surface and you did this logarithmic transform, to the Kummer surface, that, you know, the logarithmic transform, if you just kind of literally go in and see what the algebraic geometry is telling you to do, you go to one of these non-singular elliptic fibers and you twist some way around it. So you're actually cutting along some 3 torus, which is the boundary of a neighborhood of the fiber, and you're re-gluing along some explicit monodromy. That's how the differential structure is changed by logarithmic transform. And you massage this around and you figure out kind of what's the smallest little cork, he called it, that's being permuted by, or twisted by the transform. And he was able to describe that the Kummer surface had a big piece which contained, you know, all its 22 Betti number and all that interesting structures in the big piece. And then there's a little contractible cap here, you know, which is just this Maeser manifold. And all that happens when you do the logarithmic transform is you cut this Maeser manifold and you twist by exactly that diffeomorphism, interchanging the white and red circle. And that's how you change the differential structure, you know, which is distinguished by Donaldson or Seibert-Witten invariants. So that's so that proves that you couldn't extend the identity over, you couldn't extend the twist over the cap, because if you could, then these two manifolds would be diffeomorphic, contradicting the fact that they, you can compute their invariants to be different.
So, are you saying when you did that it was kind of trial and error that you just did this calculation and turned out?
No, actually, kind of in the back of our minds, you know, from childhood, we knew this, but never expressed it in this way, because being ignorant of physics, we weren't thinking of linear combinations of manifolds. So this, in a way, is like an old, forgotten fact. I don't know if anyone ever knew, checked every case here, but I think more or less these things were known. But the idea that you should make a pairing and look for nullity is kind of the, you know, adding the physics perspective to it. Yeah.
If you change the definition from diffeomorphism to homeomorphism, are there still null vectors?
No. This isn't a null vector. This is the zero vector. But there are still null vectors in the topological category. So it's not only attached to the smooth structure. Yeah, so actually, this is probably a good time to tell you what the answers are about null vectors. So in this paper, so let's make a table of D. So D could be equal to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, so on. These are the dimensions. And in this kind of lunchtime paper, we checked that there's no nullity, that this is positive. I just used the word positive to mean no nullity, no null vectors. And we found this null vector here. And it is true also there's no different nullity in the topological category. And then Teichner and Kreck very quickly afterwards produced nullity everywhere out here. So there's, and that left only dimension 3. And I think it's actually quite interesting for physics, and I'll explain this for condensed matter physics, that the new result here, which is with Kevin Walker and Danny Caligari, is that this is positive. So that's sort of the last piece. So there's still lots of questions one can ask. Yeah. Yes.
Are you saying that immediately implies it annihilates all of
your... No. It doesn't, because, in fact, it doesn't annihilate this. The difference is non-trivial applied to this punctured Coomer surface, or this ripped open Coomer surface. In fact, we have no techniques for proving that a vector pairs zero with everyone.
Okay, so you haven't actually answered the question you asked on the left side.
No, we don't know how to find true nullity.
And once you have the null vector dimension 4, you just take a product that's, you know, something and...
No, because the Donaldson invariants are unstable. The Donaldson invariants are unstable invariants. If you cross with a circle, they disappear. So in dimension 4, you have a phenomenon...
The topologist's notion of stability may not be familiar to everybody.
Oh, right. Topologists, we're used to thinking that if you had some phenomenon and you crossed with a circle, the phenomenon generally persisted. And we would call that stable under crossing with circle. Smooth structures in dimension 4 are extremely non-stable in this sense. They represent kind of a zoo of new things going on that don't have a counterpart in high dimensions. So for example, if you take this Coomer surface and its logarithmic transform, the whole reason that this vector was not just simply the zero vector, you know, why m was different from m prime, was because the closed manifold, the Coomer surface and its logarithmic transform, were distinguished. There were different manifolds in terms of their smooth structure. But if you cross them with circles to make each one five-dimensional, then they are diffeomorphic as manifolds. So that distinction just evaporates. Yeah, so you need a new construction in order to do the stuff that Teichner and Kreck did.
Is the topological null vector stable? The four-dimensional.
Yes, it is, actually. Yeah, the topological null vector is actually kind of fun. I'll just tell you what it is very quick. One of Milner's early famous contributions was focusing our attention on E8 plus E8, this lattice, versus E16. This was Milner's example of a pair of lattices that had the same length spectrum, but yet were different as lattices.
String theorists are very familiar with
this. Oh, okay, so this is this, can you hear the shape of a drum? This was the first result. It's a high-dimensional drum, but that's all right. Doesn't have a boundary and whatever. It's not made of cowhide. We've since gotten to the real drums, but but Milner was up here in the abstract world. So in topology land, these are actually four-dimensional manifolds. That is, there are unique, simply connected topological four manifolds with these matrices as their quadratic forms. Okay? Does that surprise you?
I don't know what I should have expected.
Well, like, for instance, the Coomer surface, K3, its quadratic form, you know, its integer homology is 22-dimensional. It has no torsion. And if you write if you write down what the intersection matrix is on it, or the cup product matrix, it's simply E8 plus E8 plus three copies of this hyperbolic stuff, which are like S1 cross S2s. This is like a torus, roughly, okay? So saying that this is a manifold is no more than just saying in the topological category you can eliminate the hyperbolic pairs. You can reduce them by a technique called surgery. That can't be done. This is Donaldson's theorem ABC, that you in the smooth category you can't remove these hyperbolic pairs. But in the topological category, you can. So you can make this manifold, and it turns out to be unique. And if you remove these pairs in a different way, you can make this manifold. Well, it turns out that this manifold minus that manifold, thought of as a vector in the space for just the ordinary three-sphere, so just puncture them, is a null vector. And the reason is that when you turn these things upside down, there's an orientation reversal that goes on. And the quadratic form, for example, E16 direct sum minus E16, that's the orientation reversal, it reverses the signature, is nothing sophisticated. I mean, this is a completely stable form. This is simply isomorphic to 32 copies of this form. You know, the classification of quadratic form. 16, thank you. Yes, 16 copies. Yeah. So the classification of indefinite, you see, as soon as you have a minus part, it becomes indefinite. And the classification of integral indefinite forms is very simple. It just involves the dimension, rank, and signature. So, and then the topological classification of the manifolds follows the forms very closely. So the point is, it doesn't matter in these four places whether you put in an E16 or an E8 plus E8. It doesn't matter in the four cases what goes into this formula. You get this simple form out in all cases. So that's the topological mobile.
When you say it is a null vector, did you really mean according to that definition?
No, I mean, sorry.
It's isotropic, right? That's a better thing.
Well, light-like or something.
Yeah.
I mean, pairs with itself to zero.
Right.
That's
so
what I meant.
On that table, you also are talking
that's
about.
That's what I've, yes, I shouldn't have, right. I shouldn't have used the same word for two different things. I'm sorry. Okay, so now, since you've seen that there are null vectors. I want to discuss for a minute, before I erase this diagram, I want to discuss the physical significance of a null vector. Okay? And the physical significance has to do with this unitary TQFT structure. So I gave you an extremely high-level abstract way of producing Hilbert spaces for a TQFT by taking an abstract pairing, composing, dividing by this other kind of nullity. But there's obviously a ground-up way of producing Hilbert spaces for a TQFT. Like, these things arise in the fractional quantum Hall effect. So, you know, we know that we can take the Hilbert space that represents electrons in a lattice of ions, and write down the Hamiltonian for the transverse field and maybe the electron-electron interactions. We can write down this Hamiltonian, and we know that the ground state manifold, the will have some kind of degenerate ground state for this Hamiltonian. We know that that ground state, in many cases, is some kind of very interesting Chern-Simons TQFT, maybe involving U1 and SU2. So we have a completely different way of getting to these TQFTs by looking at the condensed matter physics on D-minus one-dimensional systems. So it's natural to ask, since we have two ways of building this, we can build these from kind of condensed matter, Hamiltonians, or we can build them abstractly through manifold pairings and a action. Since we can build them in two different ways, it's natural to ask, how much could we hope to see of the manifold structure? How much information about d-dimensional manifolds could we hope is reflected in the physics of d minus one dimensional quantum mechanics? And the point is that any TQFT that's constructed from quantum mechanical interactions is simply the lowest energy manifold inside a Hilbert space of proved degrees of freedom, such as, you know, electron position and so on. So there's absolutely no doubt about the signature of the Hermitian structure on this space. It's a subspace of ordinary Hilbert space for some interacting system. So it has a positive, definite Hermitian inner product. So we know that the ones that we'll see in condensed matter are unitary. Okay? So we might as well say that these produce, you know, unitary TQFTs. Now the point is, if we have a null vector, it can never be seen in a unitary TQFT. Because in a unitary TQFT, in the structure of a unitary TQFT, if we have a vector V that pairs zero with itself, this of course implies that the vector itself is zero. Okay? That's this no light-like vectors. But on the other hand, if a vector up here in the abstract manifold context is already pairing to the zero combination of manifolds, regardless of what partition function we insert, it'll still go to zero here. So light-like vectors are invisible to unitary TQFTs. They cannot be detected. So that's a blind spot. It's something going on in topology, like the Seiberg-Witten invariant, that can't be seen in microscopic physics on a three-dimensional manifold. So this bears interesting contrast with Witten's paper. Witten wrote a paper in 88 where he tried to describe the Seiberg-Witten invariants, actually at that time they were the Donaldson invariants, as a TQFT. But he had to include something called topological twist, which took it out of the unitary world. So this is sort of a complement to what Witten did, because it shows that he needed to make that topological twist. He couldn't have found the Seiberg-Witten invariants without leaving unitarity behind. However, the result that I want, you know, kind of to direct the future lectures to, which is positivity in the three-dimensional case, means that we may not have to leave anything behind in the classical two plus one dimensional situation. That is, because of positivity here, we may hope that all of three-dimensional topology is reflected in the microscopics of two-dimensional quantum mechanical interaction. There's no obstruction to that.
Another, you don't have to twist.
Yeah, that's right.
Even
yeah.
If people did.
Well, so for example, this is very much similar to the question that is asked, do Jones polynomials and like invariants separate all knots? You know, can quantum topology see everything about topology, or are there some blind spots? You know, if you went through the partition functions of all the Chern-Simons theories at different levels, could you end up distinguishing all closed three manifolds, say? You know, these are unknown questions, but at least the possibility is there because the universal pairing is positive. If we had null vectors in the universal pairing, we'd easily be able to produce pairs of manifolds that couldn't be distinguished.
Excuse me. So you wrote here in unitary theory, if V is time-like, then V has to be zero.
Yeah.
So then why did you say time-like vector can't be seen? Well, it looks like there's no non-trivial time-like vector at all.
Well, right. So that's what I'm saying. So if you have a, not time-like, you mean light-like.
Light-like.
Yeah, so if you have a light-like vector in the universal world, that's
right.
Like, you know, this Mayser manifold minus its twist,
right.
Then it will, of course, descend in any quotient to a light-like vector.
Right.
So what I'm saying is, if the quotient is a unitary theory, being light-like means it's the zero vector.
Right.
Which means it's invisible. It can't be seen in the in a unitary quotient.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is probably a good place to pause for questions, because I think what I'd like to do next is sort of launch into the proof of positivity in dimension 3. And actually, when I said I was trying to give an exciting talk, I haven't gotten to the part that I thought was exciting. What I thought was exciting is it didn't look like this was going to work 2 months ago. You know, and the reason was is because we had noticed that proving positivity of the three-dimensional pairing actually implied some interesting inequalities about classical three-manifold topology, a subject called Heegaard genus. So when we talked to experts and found these inequalities were not known, we thought we were on the wrong track. But it turns out, actually, that thinking in kind of the TQFT formalism, you actually learn a lot about classical three-manifold topology, in particular Heegaard genus. So so the next bit of the talk, whether it's today or continued, I guess I can do a little bit still today. The next bit, the theme will be how these tools, that were given to us by Witten and Digraph-Witten, shouldn't be ignored by the professional three-manifold topologists, that even if you're only interested in classical questions about three-manifolds, these can be very potent. So maybe what I can do is set the stage for like 10 minutes by showing you what we were worried about 2 months ago, what the possible counterexample could be, a very simple counterexample, and see that in order to rule this out, you have to know some rather delicate things about three-manifolds. Three-manifold topology. Does that sound okay? So, so remember that our our D equals 4 null vector. How did it really result? It came about, what caused it is we found some double which was actually equal to a twisted double. So a double is a very straightforward thing. If you have a manifold with boundary, the double is you just take two copies of it and glue them by the identity along the boundary. So you could think that it's just something union its mirror image. Okay, that's a double. Well, here, let me make a picture like this. Here's a double. You just, whatever it was, you reflect. But a twisted double is you take the same manifold, so I'll call the twisted double T. The twisted double you're allowed to glue by something not the identity. You twist. So a picture of a twisted double might look like this, like the nightcap is pointing to the right, but then down here it's pointing to the left. We kind of twisted it. Now this is only schematic. If this is really a circle I was gluing along, then you could just, by up to deformation, twist it right back and nothing. But if you think of this as, representing something intricate in higher dimensions, then this different map here might, really lead to a different result. So, in our example, both of these were Maser manifolds, but in one case we were gluing by the identity. That actually gave the two terms with plus sign. And the terms with minus sign, where we had an M and an M prime, then the gluing was actually this exotic thing that I explained about where they interchanged the components of the red and white components. So this is the exotic gluing. And if you think the guts of the example is we found some strange situation by combinatorial fiddling around. We found some situation where doubles and twisted doubles
happen to be as closed manifolds the same, and then we simply, you know, built the vector m minus m prime, and when we paired it with itself, we got zero because two of the terms give doubles and two give the twisted double. So we tried, you know, we tried to build a counterexample in dimension three, you know, make something whose twisted double and its double give the same thing. And it looked like it was going to work. So here's what we did. We started with S1 cross S2 connected sum itself. And then we removed a wedge of circles, which is homotopic to the identity, say, but very complicated. So in order to picture this example, if you're not, you know, a working topologist, or working free manifold topologist, you should think of a genus 2 handle body, and then double it. So just take another one, that's sort of the outside, and then this becomes this space, two copies of it. Because what you see is this disk here in the handle body, that when you double it, it's mated with another disk on the outside, you know, another copy of itself, and that becomes this two-sphere. And this disk becomes this two-sphere, and this disk in here becomes the two-sphere where the connected sum is taking place. So it's pretty straightforward. And now this wedge of circles, I want to draw that. I can push it out of one of the handle bodies, so without loss of generality, I can think of it being drawn in this handle body. And the fact that it's homotopic to the identity, all I mean by that is up to homotopy, it's just that wedge of circles. But now I want a fancier version, which is all scrambled. You know, the three manifolds, that manifold topologists will say, when I cut it out, I want the boundary to be, I want it to have incompressible boundary or a hyperbolic structure or something like that. I want a nice robust example, so I could, you know, do all kinds of stuff, like, so you put in a finger that does that and tie knots, and I just deform it to some complicated mess, deform it up to homotopy, so its topological type is changing, it's crossing itself and getting really complicated in there. Okay, so that's, I just defined this, and I call this manifold X. Okay, and now let me just use a little notation. I'll use a number like 2, just to mean two copies of just the genus 2 handle body. So this will just mean S1 cross D2 connected boundary connected sum itself. So in pictures, it's just this solid thing, okay? And I'll use 2 bar to mean this thing. S1 cross S2 connected sum S1 cross S2. That's the space I just explained, which is the double of this. I just don't want to write long formulas. And now, let's think of the following. Suppose I have, and then I'll use the plus sign. I'll use this loosely to mean either boundary connected sum or connected sum, depending on whether I'm talking with manifolds of boundary or manifolds that are closed. And now let's write down the following thing. 2 plus x plus 2, and I'll take a double of this to compute its double. I'll just write 2 plus x plus 2, add it together, this is some kind of arithmetic, and it'll be 2 bar, these double, plus, this is now connected sum, double of x plus 2 bar, which is equal double of x plus 4 bar. So in other words, 4 bar is 4 S1 cross S2s connected together. So all I'm saying here is something like the operation of doubling is functorial and it commutes with connected sum. But now let's try a twisted double.
So that's the plus on the very left side of...
Oh yeah, that should be double, or glue. Does that help, Marty?
Yeah,
okay. I was sort of trying to emphasize the analogy to arithmetic. Which perhaps could be overdone. Okay, so now I want to write this as 2 plus x plus 2, and now x plus 2 plus 2. So I just So it's some different gluing, and I glue these.
And now 2 plus 2 is 4 with a bar. Oh, no, no.
2. Thank you. My mistake.
Okay, sorry. I don't want to.
I was getting ahead.
I have to say how you glue, okay? So
I'm going to have this 2 and this x, I'm going to have that give me 2 bar.
That's reasonable because x was made by subtracting a handle body of genus 2 from what I'm calling a 2 bar. So if I simply put the handle body back the same way I took it out, I can certainly achieve an S1 cross S2. So I can arrange the gluing to achieve this S1 cross S2 2 times.
And similarly, I can use the same obvious arrangement here to get that.
So far I've matched up this part.
That's good.
That was easy. Now we come to the question. Is it conceivable I could choose some interesting gluing between these two genus 2 handle bodies to get the missing term in the formula? Then I'd have a twisted double equal a double, and I wouldn't have positivity. So is it possible, I'll write this in red because this is the big question, could I arrange this to be double of x? You know, so this is a question in classical three-manifold topology. It's basically the question, does double of this interesting hyperbolic manifold have a genus 2 Heegaard decomposition? Can it be written as two handle bodies of genus 2 glued together? Every closed three-manifold can be written by gluing together handle bodies of some genus. David showed you how to do that in one of the early talks. But in general, it's hard to lower the genus. And homological constraints give you some lower bound. The homology of this thing has two generators, so you couldn't possibly get away with genus less than 2. But maybe by some fancy gluing, you could get away with genus 2. That's the question. If you could, then we'd be sunk. There'd be nullity in dimension 3. So in order to prove positivity in dimension 3, one has to establish some inequalities about Heegaard genus. This was what really discouraged us. So I think maybe the final thing that I'd like to show you today is a formalism for showing that this is impossible. And maybe talk more about this formalism next time. So in order to expand and understand this formalism in detail, we'll have to take a little time out and learn this Digraph-Witten paper about finite group TQFTs. And I'll either give that lecture or Kevin Walker will. But I think I can just sort of show you very quickly how there's a formalism that can rule this possibility out. So okay, so inside, think about the Hilbert space for the genus 2 surface. So this is just, sigma is just the genus 2 surface. And what do I mean by the Hilbert space? Well, we choose some finite dimensional TQFT. It can be anyone you want, basically. All it has to do is be smart enough to know the difference between x and 2. So in other words, we have these two different manifolds that have this as boundary. One is what we're calling 2. That's simply the solid handle body. And then we have this other thing from the other side whose boundary is this, which is x. And now suppose it's very important that V be unitary. So all we need for the for our Hilbert space, V. So this is involved in the choice of the theory. You know, there are many, many finite, there are many, many TQFTs. We could take Chern-Simons theory at some level for some Lie group, or we could take any particular finite group. But the requirements that we'll have for this argument are that V be positive definite Hermitian,
or Euclidean. And the other is that little v of 2 is just not equal to little v of x. So x is some particular manifold. So we, depending on which x we're looking at, we'd have to sort through our TQFTs till we found one. But it's pretty easy to argue using residually finiteness that we can always find such a TQFT. There won't be any problem there. But look what this says by the gluing axiom. We know that v of 2 dot with itself is equal to z of 2 bar, right? That's just the gluing axiom. Doubling gives inner product. We know that v of 2 inner product with v of x is also equal the same scalar, because x is an alternative possible complement. Just involved a different embedding. Okay? But because this inner product is taking place in a positive space, we can conclude from these two facts that the length of v of x is greater than the length of v of 2. Well, this is the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, if you want to sound like a mathematician. But this simply says that if you have a vector and another vector, and the two inner products are the same, the vector with itself and the vector with this other vector, those two inner products are the same, but the vectors are not equal, then the other vector, v of x, whose inner product is the same as the itself, has to be longer. Okay? But that means that the partition function of this double of x again by the gluing formula is simply the inner product of v of x with itself . But because this vector is longer than v of 2, this inner product with itself, it's the norm squared. The norm squared is going to be larger. So this will be strictly larger than the inner product of v of 2 with itself. Which was the partition function of the S1 cross S2 connected sum itself, z of 2. So we concluded, just from the structure of gluing, that this doubled guy had too big a partition function to have genus 2. More generally, the partition function gives a lower bound on the Hagar genus of a 3-manifold, just essentially by this argument. But in this case, we found that this double, kind of seen through the eyes of any unitary TQFT that's able to distinguish it at all from the simplest manifold, as long as it can distinguish it at all, it will think that this has larger partition function that the double has too large a partition function to be this simple manifold 2 bar. So this was sort of the exciting moment when we realized that in a way, in retrospect, it makes sense because we're trying to prove something positively about this universal pairing. So it makes sense to use as a crutch along the way known pairings. Why work just in topology if you're trying to understand the universal pairing? You can gain some information from well-studied quotients, in particular the finite group TQFTs. And what the finite group TQFTs essentially did for us in the outline of the argument is they showed us how we could throw away at least our worst nightmares about making doubles and twisted doubles equal. And of course, that's a long way from showing how to do
you know, how to formulate the proof. But I think that's what I should start with next time. And I'm thinking, David, maybe I should talk next time and Kevin the time after, something like that.
And I think we probably should meet the time after, which, even though it's Veterans Day, because it's not moving as quickly as...
Things are slow. Yeah. Good. Okay, thank you. Oh, got questions?
Do you find a particularly clever embedding that allows you to show this about me, or is it pretty much any random...
Oh, no, this is the beautiful thing. This is like essentially zero work. This whole subject is takes no work. It's my kind of math. So all you need to know is that the fundamental groups of three manifolds are residually finite. And what that tells you is that there is some, given any x, as long as x is not itself a handle body, so in other words, as long as the kernel from the surface into the three manifold is not identical to the kernel in the case of the handle body, it's very easy from that to use residual finiteness applied to the three manifold X to come up with some finite group that sees the difference. In other words, it sees that homomorphisms that factor through the handle body do not extend in the same way, in the same pattern as homomorphisms that go through X. Anyone but the standard one works. Yeah. Oh, this line here?
What does that say?
Sorry, I know my handwriting is awful. So what I'm trying to say is that the...
how does that inform you about these non-standard gluings of two?
Non-standard.
The D of X. Before, if there was some twisted gluing of two with two, that might give you D of X.
Right. So this was a... we haven't laid to rest yet the possibility that there's a double and a twisted double that are the same. All we've laid to rest is the first counterexample that came to mind, which was this one. In other words, there are many ways you could try to make twisted gluings, and I haven't begun to show that all of them are different from the doubles. But you know what I tried to show here is that we could write down a proposed twisted gluing that lived or died according to whether we could make D of X in this very simple way by gluing together two genus, two handle bodies.
I just didn't understand how you ruled that out.
Well, because it turns out the partition function of D of X is bigger than the partition function of bigger than the partition function of any manifold that can be made by gluing these two things together. The reason is when you glue manifolds together, you're dot prodding vectors. Okay, the vector v of 2 has a certain length. Okay, the largest partition function you can get is the double when you dot product with itself. If you glue it in a different way with a twist, you're applying a unitary to one of the vectors and then taking an inner product, and the partition function just goes down. Yeah, I maybe didn't explain that.
These are all unitary.
That's extremely important. The strategy has no force outside the unitarity. Thanks.